Tim Supple was artistic director of the Young Vic in the 90s. There he directed several beautiful storytelling shows, including Grim Tales, and he also directed two of Salman Rushdie's books adapted for the stage, Haroon and the Sea of Stories for the National Theatre and Midnight's Children for the Royal Shakespeare Company. Well, along with many other theatregoers, I didn't see the production in the summer. It was scheduled for little more than a week. But good news, there'll be another opportunity to see it in 2007, first at the Roundhouse in London from March the 8th until April the 21st, and then during a national tour. My name is Heather Neal, Theatre Voice, and I'm with Tim Supple now at the Roundhouse to talk about this landmark production, described by more than one critic as being as memorable and innovative as Peter Brook's in 1970. Tim, the story of this production began, I think, with a commission from the British Council. They suggested an India-wide theatre project. Why did you choose The Dream, and how on earth did you go about casting it?
Well, the first thing I did when this rather extraordinary idea was put to me of an India-wide theatre project was to start to travel and to meet people, see artists, see their work, and work with them in exploratory sessions. And while I was doing that, I was all the time thinking of how I might work with these performers and what piece would be the binding force to hold us all together. Because, of course, in India, the range of performers, backgrounds, cultures, experiences of life and of faith is really probably like no other in its range, and the difference between our Manipuri musician and our from the high northeast to our young Sri Lankan Demetrius from deep down in the south is, you know, indescribable in its width. So India, the idea of India is a political idea more than anything else. So I knew that the project needed a strong binding influence, and I read many works and considered many works, Indian works, what you might call world classics like Gilgamesh and so on. But in the end, Shakespeare was always a big possibility. Shakespeare has a great resonance in India, great importance in India. And his stories are, on the one hand, his stories are mythic and universal as human narratives, but he also is, as specific as we know, a great technical wizard. So he writes beautifully crafted plays. So I knew that whatever I did, the task of devising would be very hard. I knew I'd only be able to afford about 8 weeks rehearsal, and devising a piece of from such a disparate group would be very hard. So my thoughts narrowed onto Shakespeare. Midsummer Night's Dream is something that I've been have a deep sense of all my life, really, all my memorable life since being a child. And these pieces that have a big impact on you as a child are important, and they never leave you. But as the years go on, although I was jealous every time someone did the Midsummer Night's Dream and always thought I wanted to do that, I often considered doing it at the Young Vic, I was also a bit alienated, as I always am alienated, by an overt Englishness that I feel. And nothing against it, but I'm alienated by it. It's not my background. I'm from Jewish background. My family has only been here for around 100 years now, but one doesn't feel deeply attached to the great tradition of Englishness that can come through a piece like the Midsummer Night's Dream. So as the years went on, it actually became less likely to me that I would do Midsummer Night's Dream, because the thought of doing it through the normal processes of a British production, casting from the pool of actors through agents and doing it at the RSC or the National, it just became less and less exciting to me as I saw so many productions. But the piece itself never went away, and very passionate feelings I had about it. For instance, the extraordinary, to me absurd, tradition in England that is not escaped even in the most serious productions. There is still this tendency to see, for instance, the mechanicals as buffoons, and I always find that remarkable, sort of clowns, and there are things like that that never went away. So the Midsummer Night's Dream was in my bones, and the more I travelled around India, the more I saw the Midsummer Night's Dream as the piece that would bring these remarkably different performers together, because it's a piece that I thought would embrace and invite the remarkable variety of performers, from the magical and supernatural world to the aristocratic mythic world to the more sort of focused and realistic middle class issues facing the lovers, the very idea of lovers escaping from the city to the wilderness, you know, and of course the mechanicals themselves. And if you've ever visited India, I don't know whether you have, but when you go somewhere like Kolkata, there they are in truth and reality. To cast this project, there was only really one way to go about it, which was to travel hugely and widely. And I went to 10 cities, and in each region I had the local, when I say local I mean the regional British Council officers, who are very good arts officers, always Indian people who know the art scene fairly well. Often they tend to know the more wider known, more official, more English speaking. And of course I was very concerned to get to all artists, English speaking or not. Traditionally the kind of actors who might do Shakespeare, and others who might never have done participate in Shakespeare at all. So to do that, we worked with local, local's the wrong word, but we worked with directors who knew the region well. So we assembled groups, and because in a way I didn't know what I was looking for until I found, I just encouraged people to bring anybody who they thought might be interesting. So I started to have sessions, and I went to 10 major cities where I had working sessions, and it was really there that I began to see quite how special the mixture of people could be. And I just gave way to a different way of seeing performance in Shakespeare than I'd encountered before, including the different languages and using a mixture of languages. It all became possible to me through the auditions, which were in themselves exploratory working sessions. So the epic journey ended with me having seen hundreds of actors, and of course I couldn't decide after one journey.
So how then, long did this take?
I did it all over a year. I did an initial trip of 3 weeks, and then a casting trip of 4 weeks, and then at the end of that trip I said to the British Council that I would have to see people again. So we had no alternative but to organise a recall session for 60 performers who were flown from all over India in Mumbai, which really was a remarkable week in my life and theirs. They'd never done anything like that, and I had never done anything like that.
And already you were dealing with a lot of different languages.
Yeah, so amongst the 60 people there were 8 or 9 languages, and there were, as you mentioned in your introduction, there were people raised in who for years had been studying classical performance, folk performance, some English-speaking actors, realistic actors, musicians, guys from a performers' ghetto in Delhi, who are essentially street performers, people from the highest to the lowest castes. So it really was a remarkable gathering. And after that, I then spent the summer trying to decide who of those 60 should become the 23, you know.
And the languages, I mean, obviously the text is very important to you. How, first of all, did you rehearse with so many different languages? One interpreter wouldn't be any use. And are there already versions of Shakespeare in all these languages, or were you working with new inserts as you were going?
Well, the interesting thing is there's a limit, although there's a great knowledge of Shakespeare, there's a limited tradition of translation there. So what happens in, there are translations in Hindi, some, but in almost every other language apart from Hindi, you get versions where you get truncated versions and reduced versions. And that is partly because there's a very, very strong tradition of performing Shakespeare in English anyway.
Yes.
It's not particularly...
It has been for a couple of hundred years.
Yeah, and it's not great. Mm. It tends to be replication of a sort of old-fashioned... replication of a view of old-fashioned English acting. So what you get now in the English-speaking Shakespeare theatre a lot is... I suppose it must be sort of 50s, 60s approaches. There's a younger generation bringing a slightly different sensibility to it. But to be honest, the most exciting Shakespeare work is usually in, not in English, but therefore not in full versions of the text. So you get, it was a very famous version of The Dream done by someone called Habib Tanvir, who's a great director, in Hindi, but he cut The Lovers completely almost, and I think it was mainly about the fairies and the mechanicals. Those kind of versions tend to be about transposition, a complete transposition, which is not quite what we've done, where you completely locate it within an Indian context. So the fairies in Habib Tanvir's version, the fairies became jungle spirits, if you see what I mean, as a complete idea. And I didn't indulge in any conceptual kind of whole transposition in terms of, you know, they're like that, if you see what I mean. But this is the tradition, and the other thing is that languages like Malayalam, which is Kerala, or Tamil, are so different than English that the sort of precise translation is very hard. But that is still what we then did, is the long...
You commissioned these.
We commissioned new translations, not of the whole play, sadly, but of the very relevant parts.
And those just happened to be, according to the actors you thought would best do those parts. There was nothing to do with using particular languages but particular kinds of character or anything like that.
Subliminally, probably, but on the surface, well, the way I cast it was to think, who's the best person for the part? Who excited me most? And who did I feel brought the best spirit to the work? Because that was going to be very important, given the length of the time we were going to work together. And the ideas we had, like to rehearse it in isolation and things like that, which wouldn't have worked if people seemed to have the wrong kind of spirit. The languages very much came second, but I was aware, not necessarily in a way that I could work out quite what to do with, but I was aware of what would the implication be in the dialogues to have no access to English or some access to English. But on the whole, I let my instinct be led by the right actor. And then what actually happened is, many people in India thought I had chosen the languages politically and specifically, because actually the conventional and unthinking way to do it would have been to have the higher actors talk in a kind of high Hindi, right, which is the ruling language, as you know, and then for the fairies and other characters to possibly talk in so Hindi and Bengali for the higher characters, and the southern languages, Tamil, Malayalam, Sinhala, for the lower characters, or a lower Hindi for the mechanicals. But my intention was to try and preserve the quality of the Shakespeare, so I didn't want any sense that the mechanicals should speak anything lesser than Shakespearean prose, which is a very high language, but is a different high language to the verse. I wanted a movement between verse and prose. So if it's going to be in Hindi and it's Puck, then he has to speak in this shorter kind of verse. But if it's going to be in Malayalam and it's Oberon, then the translation has to find this longer, elevated verse. The mechanicals needed to find a prose Hindi or prose Malayalam or prose whatever they were, but one that wasn't modernised or wasn't slang in a modern sense. So it was very precise. Actually, it's interesting that the high character Oberon is Malayalam, that Puck is the servant is Hindi, that the mechanicals are a mixture of Hindi and Malayalam, Marathi, that the lovers are Bengali, Sinhala. So it's, in a way, it's completely mixed up. The fairies are Tamil, Bengali, English, Malayalam. It's completely mixed up. But I think it actually was politically very powerful in India, especially in Delhi, Bombay and Kolkata, for them to have to sit as an audience. I didn't realise this before I started, of course, but for the audience to have to sit and hear Oberon in Malayalam was actually very political. Yeah. And there was much more objection. There wasn't much, but there was much more objection in India to the language use than in England. Mm-hmm. Because it affronted a sense of rightness.
Presumably you are assuming some knowledge of the story, at least. I mean,
I'm assuming nothing.
Yeah, right.
I'm assuming nothing
so,
at all.
So, people, obviously, everyone's going to have only one or two, possibly three of those languages.
In India?
In India.
And here, only one in England.
English, probably, yeah. Except for a few people. So, they've got to be able... But here, most people will have an idea, at least, of the story.
That's true, but that's not, to me, relevant. I'm assuming nothing. I'm assuming that the story has to be told and that the play has to give its rightful pleasure and communicate itself.
Mm. And it does that by various means as well as by...
Yeah, language. Well, one thing... Yeah, exactly. It does, precisely. I mean, there are a few things to say here. First, it is 50% of it is in English. So if you're an English speaker who doesn't know the play, half of it you will know. And in a way, to the English ear, it's really in two languages, in a way, you know,
yeah.
Unless you're really interested, yeah. and then it is very interesting. But it's in English, half of it's in English and half of it's in another language. And secondly, the way Shakespeare does this brilliant thing, as we all know, he wrote plays for an audience that he assumed were only half listening. So he repeats everything three times. This is the great Ted Hughes point, you know, that Shakespeare repeats everything three times. And he does. So if you don't get it, you know, if you don't get it through one person, you're going to get it in English eventually. Thirdly, Midsummer Night's Dream is one of his simplest narratives, and in a way, one of his narratives that relies less on narrative and more on a series of events that together make up a kind of almost ritualistic experience of human... somehow the relationship between class... between our need to love and between our sense of an elevated self and a base self. And these things communicate themselves in a way very, very simply. The symbols, it's a Peter Brook word, but the symbols of it are very, very simple. So I'm sure that's why, since Brook's Dream, it has become one of the Shakespeare's that's most often used, abused, or joyously communicated through very physical and visual language. So I don't think that's that difficult, but at the same time I think an audience has to, even if they do know the play, an audience still has to attune themselves. And you find that the first scene is the shock, because you get you're bombarded with Theseus moving into Malayalam. He starts in English, but he moves into Malayalam very quickly. And then you get Sinhala from Demetrius. You get Bengali and English from Lysander. You get English from Helena, Hermia. You get Tamil from Aegeus.
I imagine the situation with Aegeus was very recognisable to Indian audiences, pressing an unwanted suitor on his daughter. Did that have particular resonances which people... mentioned to you?
Of course, the situation of the parental relationship to marriage is, as you know, everywhere in India. I mean, even the most liberal, most modern child. I've never met an Indian resident who, of whatever philosophy or political economic experience, who does not have this complicated relationship with their parents about marriage. I mean, it's everywhere, to different shades and degrees. I'd say a third of our cast had in some way traumatic relationships with their parents over marriage, and often entire splits, and people not talking to them for years. So, absolutely resonates everywhere. But that's true of a lot of Shakespeare.
Yes.
I mean, as one member of our cast said, who's from Rajasthan, he said, our lives are basically, fundamentally, Elizabethan. That's at Rajasthan rather than Bombay. Yeah. But there's an awareness within India. The conditions of Shakespeare are still living in India in a way that everybody is aware of, whether or not they all live that life.
What about the mythical, spiritual side of the play?
Ditto. The idea of a spirit, a mythological spirit, supernatural existence, again, is alive. It's not just an idea like it is here. It's not just a thing that some people like to believe in. It's alive and present.
Yeah. You've cast, as happens in England too sometimes, doubling. You've doubled Oberon and Theseus, Titania and Hippolyta and Puck and Philostrate. But are you saying something more with that doubling? Are you saying that the fairy world is resonates with the human world? Are there parallels here?
I think that, to me, it's the question is, what are we as beings, and are we we reach for our higher selves, obviously, generally and individually. We aspire to a higher self, partly because we must feel in some way that that's desirable, but also because we would like to believe in some immortality within ourselves, I feel. So we're interested in ideas like the spirit, the soul, and so on. But we also need to indulge in our lower selves, because we have appetites that we don't want to let go of. Food, drink, humour, sex. And the phenomenal brilliance to me of Midsummer Night's Dream is in the metaphor of the forest. He forces all characters to go on radical journeys in various directions between these two extreme poles. So you get these lovers who've grown up in a very cherished and privileged existence, free of all pain and torment, but also therefore denied the very important experience of their baser selves. And the forest, in a very frightening way, gives them a crash course in their baser selves. So they rip each other to bits, and they want to have sex with each other, and they become animalized. And for me, this is the point, and this is what we try to achieve in the production. They become absolutely raw and naked and stripped and furious, and we have the scene in which Lysander and Helena are going to have sex, if it wasn't for Puck's intervention, and the scene in which Hermia, despite herself, is desperate to have sex with Demetrius.
Isn't there a near rape?
Demetrius goes for Helena, yeah, but is held back by her. Fundamentally, he's held back by that part of himself which must deeply love her, and that's why they get together in the end. But he's challenged by her. But this, so, and then in reverse, the bottom of the play, the bum, the arse, is elevated to the king of the fairies. He experiences. He's the only human being, and I always find it very moving when I contemplate it. He is the only human being who experiences elevation, and this is why, for me, the tradition of buffoonery is a scandal. For me, it's a cultural scandal, and to do with British innate class snobbery, that working class characters have to, in the end, be clowns. It's the reverse. Why does Shakespeare end the play with him? By the end of the play, I mean the end of the action. Yes. And then you've got the dances at the end, which are very beautiful. Yeah. Why? Because he carries. He's the only human who's crossed to the other side. And he knows that, even if he doesn't know it.
Doesn't know quite what's happened.
He doesn't know it at all. Yeah. But he carries that. And what the brilliance, the second wave of brilliance, the Midsummer Night's Dream, in my opinion, is the bigger metaphor that lies outside the metaphor of the journey to the forest and back. The bigger metaphor is theatre. So it's through theatre that ultimately Bottom can reacquaint himself with the spirit world. And this is the thing for me about Pyramus and Thisbe, which is terribly important. Pyramus and Thisbe has become a dustbin of directors' and actors' ideas of how to make it funny, and how to show them how many mistakes can the mechanicals make. And it's the opposite. It's the opposite. Pyramus and Thisbe is the means by which the play brings all its strands together and touches on another possibility. Which is not to say that it's not extremely funny, but it's not only funny. And its funniness must be found in relation to its beauty, and it's great achievement in the lives of those men. Great achievement to stand in front of a group of people who have power of life and death over you, who you never get to see in life at all. You never get near in life, and stand and do a play about which you know nothing, because you're all amateurs anyway. Apart from, well, you're all amateurs. It's just there's one guy who thinks he can write and one guy who thinks he can act, and yet they do it, and it does lead to the finale of the play. So. And the great thing about India is that the conditions, it's not just the father and marriage that's in India. It's this relationship between rich and poor, this extreme difference. I mean, unless you go to India, it's hard to imagine. We have rich and poor, but, you know, in there you don't go near people. People don't go near each other. You're not allowed to. You're not allowed to address and touch. It is a completely... okay, they don't have the power in life and death anymore, officially, but it's extremely powerful, that difference. But also, the other thing that's alive and very much alive and well in India is this idea of the transformation of the self through ritual, which is what Bottom goes through, the idea of the shamanistic journey. I saw several performances of various forms of... trance dance performances in which you work into a trance and then you go and you visit the spirit world and you come back and you tell people about it. That's a fundamental idea in traditional idea in Indian performance. It's where we know all theatre comes from, that, and it's still there in India. So again, it was very inspiring to work in India and then understand that that's what Bottom does.
What happens between him and Titania? Does Titania learn anything from him? She's horrified, of course, but...
Well, Titania needs to...
Do they have a sexual relationship?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they do. In our production, not on stage, because it's not in the script.
No.
But it's absolutely in the script that they have had a sexual relationship, that they are having a sexual relationship during that night. Mm. I'm sure. And we make that clear. We all need the other side of ourselves. I very much completely agree with Yancott that basically the Titania thing is about her need to have sex with an animal, her need for bestiality, because we all want to indulge in things that we're not allowed to indulge in. And
but it only happens because her husband has played a trick on her.
Yeah, absolutely. But he's not strictly her husband. I mean, they're king and queen of the fairies.
Yes.
So you're putting a very
That's
putting a very kind of humanoid term onto them. Yeah, I'm not saying it's nice. It's horrible and painful, vicious. She has sex with a big beast all night. I mean, it's not going to be fun. But the forest, I do believe that the forest allows or forces the characters to confront the thing that they want but don't want to want, and or want but might never have in normal circumstances. So as well as being her husband, he's also a force of nature.
Yes.
They're forces of nature. So what Puck does to the lovers is what their psychology do to themselves, in a way.
Right.
And what Oberon does to Titania.
So he wouldn't be able to do it unless they were ready for it to happen to them, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's all Oberon and Puck are, is they're agents of our needs and desires. Mm. So, it's a Yancott idea, but what happens to the lovers is simply the same as, on one level, is the same as what might happen between two pairs of student friends on a bad long night. You're going to regret terribly, but you're going to learn from, and you're going to move on from. I mean, I feel with Titania that, and this is why your first question going back, yes, absolutely, Titania and Hippolyta are the same person in my mind. So, and Oberon and Theseus, the same person. So ultimately, it feeds back into Hippolyta and Theseus's journey to finding some possibility of a love in each other, because they start the play as warrior enemies.
Yeah.
She's forced to marry him, and seems to me clearly doesn't want to. She's a prisoner. That's what it seems to me. Mm. And you get them at the beginning and them at the end, and so the whole play has to be about their journey. Mm. And the journey between Oberon and Titania is part of it.
Mm. Interesting. It's a little Indian boy they're fighting over.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think you don't have little drops put in the eyes. The faces are smeared. Is that right? Why was this?
Well, I mean, for a start, I mean, for me, the whole journey, right? I mean, I hold my hands up. I'm not a conceptualist, so for me, it's not about saying, well, I think the misogyny would work well like this. Even like India, is not like, oh, it would work well in India. Actually, it does superbly, but that's not the point. The point is that for me to get really inspired, I need to be freed from a certain set of cliches, which I can, you know, you might say, well, you know, you should grow up and stay in England and free yourself from it. You don't have to travel thousands of miles, but I do actually. I have to get away from my own background of cliche to be re-inspired. That's what's happened to me in recent years. So then one goes to India and one finds a different ways to dance, different ways to fight, different ways to be magical, different ways to love on stage, different ways to do everything. And then one brings one's own as well, and you get a really interesting kind of journey. So things like magic potion from a flower. Well, actually, to be honest, if I'm using my nose, I would say to you, I don't find little drops in eyes theatrically very interesting. I've seen it so many times, it's very little action. Mm. I can see what that's about. It's about transforming the personality without anything being shown on the face. And I can also think about going into the eyes, the way you look.
That's
yeah?
right, doing
absolutely.
What they see.
No, it's beautiful. It's
see.
Beautiful. So we keep that. It's smeared on the eyes.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is that this thing of putting powder on the face is part of is a huge
Indian
part
ritual.
Of Indian magical ritual. Mm. And also, for me, the smearing of red, it's red on the eyes, and powder, gives them its extraordinary look, where they're kind of, it's a sort of intensity in the gaze. It's a mixture of things. It's a much more interesting action, though, and it's a much more interesting, what happens is that, because, you know, I didn't decide this. Some things I did decide before rehearsals, but on the whole, and actually the flower, to be honest, we didn't really finalise what we'd do with the flower till just before the show. And what we had in the end is this very beautiful cane flower, quite big. You might have seen it, because it was used in a lot of the photographs with the reviews. It was used like next to Michael's review in the Guardian. It's a very beautiful, clearly not organic flower, made out of cane by a genius man in Delhi who made a lot of our props. And then inside the flower there are pods, and then he has the pod and he breaks it, Oberon. It's a wonderful action. He breaks it and then you get this whoosh, cloud of red dust. Mm. It just has much more intensity for me than a little flower and you go pee. That's just, you know. But then, as I say, I slightly have a reaction against. Now, you have to be careful of reactions against. They can only get you so far, but they can be useful to creative energy. I have a reaction against the whole English setting of the dream. It's just
because it's too contained and civilised and...
Yes, or that's what it's become so to me. Yeah. To me, just to me, I mean, that's how I read it.
What do your fairies look like? I mean, we've got used in this country to... We've moved away from... Victorian
prettier
ones, but we've had punk ones and aggressive
had
ones and male ones
and circus ones.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what
well, again, it's like this. This one was. In fact, we had a set of costumes that were going to be used until right up to the dress rehearsal, and it's only really, I think, at the during the dress rehearsal that the final costumes came. So, you know, this was again a very long journey with the designer of probably about 8 different phases of fairy designs. The point about the forest and the fairies in the theatre for me is that it needs to be, it being the natural world, needs to be as flexible as possible. That was the basic idea between me and the designer, that rather than being one idea like light bulbs or umbrellas or this or that, it needed to be very changeable. So in a way, the forest is a psychological state, but the way you change it needs to always be like a playful metaphor for whatever trees or foliage it is. So in a way,
because it's all about change, isn't it?
It's all about change. It is all about change, absolutely. But also, the journey of the mechanicals and the lovers in the forest is about, if you imagine a kind of, you know, Blair Witch Project nightmare, long night, it keeps changing. So some places it'll be all in your face, some places it'll be thick round your legs, some places it'll feel high, some places it'll be kind and gentle, and some places it'll be harsh and savage. So really, for me, it was a direct connection with how I worked on Grimm's, but with much, much more imaginative resources, because it's Shakespeare. But it was the same idea, where, you know, a bucket, a piece of string, and then you make things work to reflect how it feels to the characters. So fairy tale is a basic folktale idea. Mm. You show it from how it feels. But also, I love the idea that the fairies, rather like the nymphs in Ovid or something, are absolutely beings of the natural world that they are, so of water or trees or whatever. But that they, because of their playfulness, their theatricality, again, they change from, depending on what the scene is, they can be benevolent or malign. They can be cheeky or vicious. They can be deadly. That's nature. I was trying to capture nature. That's what nature's like. So if you watch something like Touching the Void, that's nature at its most savage, bleak and unyielding. But, you know, a lovely nature programme, or those lakes in India where it's magical. So it's trying to capture this thing. So the fairies first appear. They're at war. We know they're at war. We've talked about the fight. The fairies first appear in a phenomenally brilliant and potent stick work. There's nothing on stage for the forest but other than them and this earth that we have and this scene. And when Titania goes to sleep in the lullaby, there's the lullaby when Titania goes to sleep before Oberon comes and puts the thing in it. We have these ropes and silks, and then you get a sense of height, and the fairies can climb and dance on these ropes and silks beautifully and powerfully. And this is the charm. And she goes to sleep in the air in one of these silks, which she wraps herself up in, and you don't know how she does it. It's sort of magical thing. It's not magical, it's just skillful. And in a later scene in the forest, they have, with the mechanicals, they have these big banana leaves and reproductions that we made out of cloth and cane of these big leaves. So you actually get an image of those big foliages that you get in Indian forests. But when the lovers have their great long scene of fight, you know, the great long scene where they get confused, the puppet scene, yes, the fight scene, Puck makes a web on the stage at sort of between chest and knee height out of elastic. So what starts as an empty stage ends as a complete impossible tangle of spider web elastic. So each scene gives a different impression of the physical nature of that part of the forest, if you imagine it like that. But it also gives a different characteristic, tone of being that reflects the experience that the human characters are going through. Now, the costumes have to allow our imagination in, therefore the costumes have to allow us to see the fairies as we want to see them. So in a sense they are costumes to costumes to free us rather than costumes to say what the fairies are. So they're the opposite than the punk clown weirdo whatever approach, and certainly not the Victorian Gosmer thing. But what they're based on, to try and describe them after a long introduction, is they're based on the kind of they're based on the clothes of Indian, contemporary Indian folk performance, which is actually, when I say contemporary, it's unchanged for about 2,000 years. Yes. They're based on light cotton pants and bare chest, and they're all black, and they are they're stunning spirits of the stage.
Right. Well, I think people will have to come see
me. I think so. You might have to describe it.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. Can I just ask you, people often try to explain whose dream it is, or I've seen productions where they do. Mm. Is it Bottom's dream, or is it our dream, or is it a dream in which all the characters move through a change and come through back into normal life as represented by the forest?
It's probably more the latter than anything else, but I would say I don't know is my answer to that. I would say I don't know whose dream it is. It's all these things. It's about, I mean, to me it would be absurd to say it's Bottom's dream, but it's about different dreams, and it is in itself, you could say, a dream, as you described. But as I said, I say in my introduction to the show, in the programme, I've got a short piece where I say basically it's as Bottom says himself, it's a dream that hath no bottom. I can't say those things about the play, and I don't pretend to. I don't know is the answer. I'm still finding out.
Well, thank you very much, Tim Supple. I look forward to seeing it very
Pleasure.
Much indeed.
Pleasure.